Welcome to another episode of the Gay Bar Time Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and our guest today is Tim Olson, who will be regaling us with stories of the bars from Long Beach and Los Angeles from the 1970s and 80s. But welcome to the show, Tim.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Excellent. So you ready to take a little stroll down memory lane?
Absolutely.
So we talked about the area, you know, right now, I guess you live in Las Vegas. Is that right?
No, I live in Las Vegas now.
Okay. But back in the 70s and 80s, your bar experiences were largely in the Long Beach and Los Angeles areas of California.
Right, right. I grew up in a suburb just north of Long Beach, so I went to Long Beach State. So my first experiences were in gay bars in Long Beach.
But one of the bars you mentioned looks like it was a pretty fabulous place. It was called Victor Hugo's. Why don't you tell me about Victor Hugo's?
Well, Victor Hugo's, it was an absolutely fabulous place. And people are still talking about it to this day, even though it closed around 1976, I think. I'm not quite sure how long it had been open previously because I came out at 19 and I just, the bar had already been thriving for several years. And, but it was an incredible space. It was just on the outskirts of downtown Long Beach on Broadway. And it was rather huge for a bar. It had several different rooms. It had a regular, you know, bar with a bartender if you wanted to just sink and sit and have a drink. It had a pool room. It had about a 50-seat room for, you know, shows like cabaret shows and hypnotists and things like that. But really the crown jewel of the place was its disco. I mean, now, today, it would be all the cliches that we think of as a disco, but back then, it was fabulous. It was, you know, they had the mirror ball at the top and lots of strobe lights and confetti and things like that. It was an incredible place to come out, and it was very exciting. And that was right at the beginning of disco, so you had all of those fabulous songs, you know, of course, Gloria Gaynor and Hughes Corporation and the Bee Gees and all of that stuff. And so it was an incredible place to dance at. And one of the great things about Victor Hugo's is that the bartender who worked the room to serve the drinks was this very tall, 6'3", 6'4", rather large, well, very large man who called himself Mama Chuck. And the great thing about him is he would dress in Carmen Miranda style headdresses while he was working the room, and everybody loved him. He was just a hoot. And, you know, I loved going to that bar. I pretty much exclusively went to Victor Hugo's for the first maybe 6 months after I came out. I'd gotten a fake ID at 19 and I never looked back. One of the other stories I have about Victor Hugo's, excuse me a second, is that on closing night, they had Charles Pierce came to give a performance, a farewell performance to thank the bar because they would host his shows quite often in Long Beach. For those who are unfamiliar who Charles Pierce was, in the 60s, he was probably one of the two most famous female impersonators working in California, in the United States even. Very renowned. There's a biography out about him, and he was quite extraordinary. He did several characters, but the character he was most famous for was Betty Davis. And so he was doing his Betty Davis routine that night, and the place was packed. And I was sitting on the floor in the front because there was nowhere to sit, so several of us were sitting on the floor right in front of the stage. And during his routine as Betty Davis, he decided to pull me out of the crowd and make jokes along the lines of, you know, here's this street hustler that's here tonight. And I don't remember the jokes specifically, but they were good natured. And I played along, and he thanked me for it. So that was very exciting to be part of, you know, such a famous person's act.
Yeah, I remember I saw him perform one time. It was later in his career. It was in the mid-80s. He performed in Atlanta, and he was the one character that really sticks out of my mind was his Betty Davis.
Yeah,
I distinctly I can see one of the skits that he did. He strolls up there, you know, in his Betty Davis persona, and looks at the audience and asks for a cigarette. And somebody tosses a cigarette up onto the stage. And he picks it up and looks at it with this, you know, Betty Davis glance at the cigarette and throws it back and says, "Lit." And it just had the whole place in hysterics.
Yeah.
Now, what kind of crowd did Victor Hugo's get mostly? It looks, when I look at the picture, it looks like it was a little bit of a kind of formal place that you would almost dress up a little bit to go to, and it doesn't look like a little, you know, old warehouse that was turned into a bar. It looks like a proper place that maybe your parents would be proud to walk into. And so it kind of gives me the illusion I would expect to have, you know, maybe a little bit more mature crowd, you know, not so much the teenagers or whatever, but a little bit more polished and reserved crowd. Was that the case, or was it?
Well, no, not really. The building itself must have been there for a long time, and I'm sure at some point it was an upscale restaurant. So the facade does look rather upscale, but it was just your typical Long Beach crowd. It was a mixture. Some crowds back then, and some of the bars in Long Beach back then, did have discriminatory policies towards people of color. But Victor Hugo's wasn't one of them. So there was a good mixture of just mostly gay men. You didn't see women in there that often. Mostly gay men between the ages of, you know, from the early 20s to maybe 40 or so. And it was primarily a dance club. And people just dressed, you know, Long Beach is the great thing about Long Beach that I love more than the other parts of LA is it's a real sort of working class vibe there. And so people can dress and be comfortable, and you don't have to go crazy to try to make yourself look as groomed as possible like you might do in some of the LA bars. It was much more casual.
I just recently did an interview with someone who, a little bit after, you were talking about the mid to late 70s there.
Yes.
Right around 81, he moved there at 17 years old and became a street hustler there and lived there for quite a while. In fact, I think he still lives in that general area. And he said by the early 80s, a lot of the area around there was a little bit decaying. A lot of the buildings were older and a little run down. One of his favorite bars that he had mentioned from Long Beach is one that you've also mentioned to me, and that was Ripples.
Ripples, yeah.
Yeah. Ripples was on the beach, correct? It was originally directly on the
beach. It was right on the beach, yes. It was right across the parking lot from right across the street from a parking lot where people would park if they were going to go to the, you know, to the sand or into the water.
So now, how did Ripples compare to Victor Hugo's as far as the crowd and the energy and the atmosphere? Were they at all similar or were they very different?
Well, they were similar in that they attracted primarily a younger crowd. It was a two-story bar. It wasn't nearly as big as Victor Hugo's, but it was a two-story bar, and the lower story had a traditional bar kind of vibe, and the upstairs was the dance area. And I loved Ripples at first, but I was a member of the Gay Students Union in Long Beach State, and we ended up boycotting Ripples for years because if you were young and white, they just wave you into the bar. But if you were a person of color, they suddenly would ask you for two or sometimes three IDs to get in. And so once, you know, our friends started to complain that they couldn't get into the bar, we decided that maybe we needed to make a statement. So we just stopped going. So I don't know how much it hurt the business there because Ripples lasted forever. It probably endured longer than any other bar in Long Beach, but they didn't have our business because I just didn't feel, you know, comfortable patronizing a place that would be so openly discriminatory. One of the owners was a Latino, so it was sort of ironic, but that's the way it was.
And that was the case in a lot of bars back then. A lot of people probably that are listening to this or watching this may not understand that we're talking about only a handful of years after the Stonewall riots in New York. So the fact that these two bars were large and in your face, they were not hiding. They were not little hole-in-the-wall gay bars with blacked-out windows that you enter from a back alley parking lot, you know, with a secret passcode. These were, you know, Victor Hugo's is on a main thoroughfare, sitting right there proudly saying, here I am. Ripples is right on the beach. This was unusual for the gay scene at that time in general in the United States. And right. I understand from other people I've spoken to about, I know Ripples in particular, they had a number of incidents where people, we'll just call them haters because we don't know who they were exactly, would harass the people waiting in line to get in. Was that the case at Victor Hugo's also, or?
No, not at Victor Hugo's, but at Ripples, there were problems like that. One person I knew that worked at the same salon as the person who cut my hair was just walking from the bar to his car in the parking lot, and he got beaten up so severely that they had to rewire his jaw. It was, you know, and that happened regularly. And also, Victor Hugo's was a little notorious because one of our famous freeway killers who would prey on young gay men or, you know, young men in general, picked up several people in the parking lot outside of Ripples during his spree before he got caught. So, but one thing that people don't realize about Long Beach in general is that Long Beach has had a historic gay community that went all the way back to World War II. Like San Francisco, Long Beach was a heavy Navy port. And so after the war, many, many people got discharged to Long Beach. And so people who had been in the service who were gay and didn't want to go back to their small Midwestern hometowns decided to stay in Long Beach. So Long Beach had a sizable gay community for, you know, ever since the 40s. And I think it had a well-established system of gay bars that stretched back quite a ways too. So it wasn't like a city where, you know, everything was hidden and everything was subterranean. There was much more of an openness. I always felt safe in Long Beach, and I never got harassed. And I hear stories from my contemporaries about what happened to them in whatever city they lived in. And it was a different experience than what I had.
Yeah, I know a lot of cities have their own personality. And around that time, I guess in the late 60s or into the 70s, Los Angeles was known for their police department being particularly harsh on gay bars and their patrons. And I've come to understand that the reason that some of the bar scenes flourish so much in places like Long Beach or what we now know as West Hollywood is because they were outside the city limits and the sheriff's department was more lenient and more accepting. And in general, they just allowed people to be themselves a little bit more so than in the heart of the city of Los Angeles.
That's absolutely true. That's exactly why West Hollywood became a mecca for gay bars and gay people, was because it was in unincorporated LA County. Now, right next to Long Beach was an unincorporated area named Wilmington, which is where the Diamond Horseshoe was. And I'm sorry, it was originally unincorporated, but then the city of LA annexed it. And even though it was just a mile or two away from Long Beach, the bars in that area did have significant incidences where the police would come in and just arrest people for no reason, beat up people for no reason. This happened. In fact, there was another bar in Wilmington called The Patch, which was a few years before my time, but it one day the patrons fought back. This was many, well, not many years, but maybe half a dozen years before Stonewall. There were some incidences in LA where the patrons did fight back when they were being harassed by the police. These incidences just didn't get the coverage that Stonewall did, but they did predate Stonewall.
Right. And a lot of people, I've said this before in other segments, but a lot of people don't realize that Stonewall was not the beginning of anything.
Absolutely.
Stonewall was kind of that last straw that got public attention because it was in a very populous city in a neighborhood that had a lot of gay people in it. And there was a lot going on in New York City as far as corruption with, you know, mafia-owned bars and all these other things. Mm-hmm. And it was just the last straw that hit at the right time. But I know in California, for example, there were incidents at the Black Cat in San Francisco and the Black Cat in Los Angeles,
right?
As well as one of my favorite uprisings, which was 1959, I believe it was, at Cooper's Donuts.
Right.
Which, of all places, you know, a little donut shop down the street from a gay bar. And in the middle of the night, cops come in to harass some sex workers and transvestites. And the next thing you know, there's an uprising. They're throwing cups of coffee and donuts at police officers. A lot of people don't know about those things. But there were a lot of uprisings like that around the country that never really got the press or got the momentum behind them that Stonewall did.
I think you hit the nose on the head when you said that it happened in New York, because, you know, a lot of people feel that something hasn't happened until it's happened in New York. But L.A. had, I mean, the Mattachine Society started in Los Angeles. In San Francisco, they had, you know, the lesbians started up. I can't remember the name of the newspaper that they started. You know, did Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon. There was a lot of political gay activity going on in California from the 50s on.
Right.
So, and there's always this eternal argument about, is Stonewall the catalyst of the modern gay rights movement? Or was it Frank Kameny in Washington? Or was it Harry Hay in Los Angeles? You know, it's just an internal argument, an eternal argument, and I don't know if it's ever going to be definitively resolved.
You also mentioned to me another bar that I researched, and I had a really hard time. I found one ad for this bar. It's called the Diamond Horseshoe.
Right.
And my research indicates, and whether or not this is accurate, it's hard to say, but was it only around for about 5 or 6 years, or is that just an anomaly in the research?
It closed in the late 70s, but I don't know how long it had been open before I came out, because it definitely was open when I first came out.
Yeah, the One Archives in Los Angeles lists them as being in business from 1973 to 79.
Oh, okay. Well, that's possible. I went there a lot too when I was, when I first came out. But it was in Wilmington, so it was sort of out of the way. Most of the gay bars in Long Beach were clustered around the corridor of Broadway Avenue, maybe a block or two off of that, one way or the other. But with few exceptions, most of the bars were all in that part of town. So to go to the Diamond Horseshoe, you'd have to spend 10, 15 minutes going out of your way. And it was in a very industrial, sort of desolate part of town. There was it was close to the port of Los Angeles, and there were oil wells and industrial buildings and that kind of thing. And then there was this bar right in the middle of it. So, but there were older patrons there that I had talked to at times, and they had talked about in previous days how the cops would come in and harass them, and that there were plainclothes men who came, policemen who came in often. They even, the DJ had a song he would play whenever they recognized that there were plainclothes policemen in the bar to let the other patrons know to watch themselves. I think I came on the scene right after if they weren't arresting people for just touching each other. I mean, you have to do something lewd in order to be picked up, at least in Long Beach. I don't know about other places, but they did have undercover cops in there a lot. And, of course, the undercover cops were really active if anything lewd was going on in the bars or in any, bathrooms and parks or things like that. People would get arrested.
The ad that I'm looking at for the Diamond Horseshoe, the picture they use in their ad lends me to believe that the theme of the bar was kind of country, Western, Levi kind of crowd. Is that accurate, or is that just this particular ad? They chose to show a shirtless cowboy with a big horseshoe.
Well, that was to attract patrons, but I mean, the people who were there would dress similarly to any other bar. There wasn't specific dress codes at any bar, and there wasn't specific kinds of, everybody just sort of dressed for a night out, casual, well, back then a lot of flannel shirts and things like that, the whole Castro clone look. But the ads that showed the real muscular cowboys or the Tom of Finland type of looking things, that was just to attract people to the bar. It wasn't reflective of who was patronizing the bar.
Now, compared to the other two bars we've discussed so far, Victor Hugo's and Ripple's, Diamond Horseshoe was a smaller bar, or was it also a pretty large place?
It wasn't a tiny bar. It was probably the size of Ripple's, I would think. It was one floor, though, not two. Most of the bars in Long Beach that were small, sort of hole-in-the-wall kind of things, were primarily just bars to go drinking, and maybe there'd be pool tables, but places like the Mine Shaft. They'd be playing music, of course, current music. But any of the bars that had discos in them, they were a fairly large size. I mean, not the size of Studio One, of course, but I don't think any bar was that size on the West Coast.
That bar was quite amazing.
Yeah,
I've heard so much about it. It was originally called The Factory, I believe.
Right.
And then it changed
because to Studio. It was a factory originally.
Originally it was a film factory, making film for the Hollywood movie industry. Right. And then it eventually got converted into a bar, which was called The Factory. And then it was converted to Studio One, which also had, the back room or backstage, or what was the, there was a show bar attached to Studio One that had a different name. I can't think.
There was a cabaret that was attached to it. It was called
Back the Lot or something like that.
It was called the Back Lot at one time, and then it became the Rose Tattoo.
Oh, yeah.
They did a lot of cabaret acts there. I mean, even people, pretty high caliber people like Liza and stuff would perform there from time to time. But usually it was lesser known cabaret acts, but it was a fairly intimate space. In fact, that was the place where I met my partner of 31 years, Marty Kreloff. We met there my next door neighbor was doing, it was a cabaret artist and was doing a show there. And he asked me to work the door for him because the deal was that the bar gave the gate to the performer and all of the drink, the money, revenue generated from the drinks went to the house. So he needed someone at the door to collect the money for the entrance fee. And that's how I met my partner, Marty.
Very cool. And it's lasted how many years?
31 years.
31 years.
Yeah.
That's quite a while. So what did you, how, when you went to Los Angeles and experienced Studio One, how did that differ from the scene that you had seen in Long Beach with, you know, Victor Hugo's and Ripples? How did they compare? Was it a different energy, a different?
Yes. Well, it's a different, people in LA, especially people that work in the industry, are different than people that live in Long Beach. As I mentioned before, Long Beach is a very working class kind of city. People don't put on airs. They're just who they are is who they are. But when you go up into LA, you've got people that, are what you would think of stereotypically of people who worked in the business. And there would be a lot of posing going on, a lot of inauthentic people. I mean, I hate to say it that way, but as a bar, it was very, very exciting because it was huge and there were so many people there. And it was really the West Coast equivalent of Studio One. So you always had celebrities, you know, they're dancing on the floor with everybody else. I'm dancing with someone and I casually look over and 10 feet away from me is Cher dancing with somebody.
Right.
You know, you'd have that kind of experience all the time at Studio One. And so people went there because they loved the music. They loved the environment. They loved seeing celebrities. But one thing that was noticeably different about Studio One is that there was a lot of drug usage that would go on just on the dance floor. I don't know how they got away with it.
I think that goes right into what you said earlier about it being like the Studio 54 of right. the West Coast, because that's exactly what happened at Studio 54. I mean, it was the high profile celebrities, the beautiful people, the people that are trying to show off, you know, everybody's putting on airs and trying to be grand and fabulous. And of course the drug scene and money laundering and whatever else was going on at Studio 4 allegedly is what caused it to collapse after 3 or 4 years. But Studio 1 in LA lasted a while.
It did, it did. There was, you'd walk in and the first thing you'd smell when you'd walk in that club is a heavy smell of just poppers in the air, because people just when they were dancing they just used poppers openly, which wasn't illegal, but you saw a lot of that and you saw a lot of coke usage. You'd always see coke people going into the bathroom and doing a line or whatever. I mean, that kind of thing was common, but to do it right out on the dance floor and not have the place shut down was pretty amazing. You know, back then in the mid-70s, I don't think people realized yet what damage cocaine could do to people and how addictive it was and how it could ruin people's lives and, you know, people could OD. It was thought of almost similarly to the way people think about marijuana. It was just a recreational drug. Oh, we'll do a couple lines. We'll go have some fun, that sort of thing. And it wasn't until the 80s, really, when people started to realize just, you know, how dangerous it was to mess with cocaine.
Right. And unfortunately, it also had a glamorous side to it, mm-hmm. because it wasn't, you know, bums on the street that were doing cocaine. It was the titans of industry. It was the big movie stars and the people who had power and, you know, had glamorous lifestyles. So whether you enjoyed it or not, you felt like doing it made you part of that group of people. It made you belong to, you know, a higher class of people, so to speak.
Oh yeah. You wouldn't just see it in the bars. You'd see it at parties.
Yeah.
people just right, you know, passing a bowl of coke around, you know, everybody doing it. That was very common in the 70s. And as I said, I don't think it, you know, people started to refrain until well into the 80s, when people started to realize that it could spiral into a problem for them. But yeah, back then it was omnipresent in LA.
Well, and the other thing too, I think, is cocaine was a stimulant. It kind of kept you alert and awake. So it did a couple of things. It kind of offset the effects of alcohol if you were drinking. So you wouldn't get sloppy drunk and fall on the floor at 2 a.m. And it also allowed you to party, because in that time frame, when the disco scene kind of emerged across America, you also started to see a huge expansion of after hours parties. And some of the bars were licensed to stay open later without alcohol. Some cities, I lived in Atlanta in the 80s, and we had a bar there that had a 24-hour liquor license. They were allowed, not only were they allowed to serve 24 hours a day, but they could never close their doors. If they ever shut down for 1 hour without a bartender, they would lose their 24-hour liquor license.
Wow.
So people would go there. I've heard stories from people on the West Coast as well as the East Coast and Atlanta, who would go out on a Thursday night and wouldn't get home until Sunday, because they would just keep doing drugs and dancing and carrying on, and they never leave the bar.
Well, that's the way it is here in Vegas. I mean, the casinos never close and the bars never close, and you can get a drink 24/7 here. So
how long have you lived in Vegas?
I've lived here for 15 years.
So do you remember there was a project that was advertised and promoted all over the place that was supposed to be like the world's largest gay bar ever? They were planning a 60,000 square foot gay bar. I think, was it over at the center called Neonopolis or?
Yes, Neonopolis, which was a facility that's in hardcore downtown Las Vegas, along Fremont Street. It was really an ill-advised project from the start, because Fremont Street is not where gay people go in Las Vegas if they, you know, want to enjoy themselves.
Yeah, I think that gigantic project was called Crave with a K.
But there was a very successful Crave bar that operated in on the Strip. But then they wanted to move to, you know, they wanted to have the biggest, and they wanted to move to downtown. And I couldn't understand why, because I didn't know how they were going to attract throngs of people down to downtown. They must have got a lot of, you know, tax breaks or whatever, because the city desperately wanted to fill that space. Neonopolis had many businesses go in there and go out of business within a year. And so they were desperate to find someone to fill that space. And so they must have, offered such an attractive, business situation that they decided to take a chance, but it never got off the ground.
Yeah, it was kind of unfortunate to hear that, because, you know, you always dream of having the Taj Mahal somewhere in the gay world. And it's nice to hear that somebody wants to do it, but then it doesn't happen, and you kind of wonder who is going, you know, is somebody eventually going to do it? Of course, given the last almost 2 years, we've seen so many bars that have closed. Some bars that have been around for 40 years or more, some bars that were practically brand new. And with the combination of COVID and the change in the gay dating scene with all the apps like Grindr and everything, and the general acceptance that a lot of younger gay people hang out with straight or non-gay friends and go to, you know, Applebee's. It's changed quite a bit. And I really miss the energy that there was when you used to be able to walk in, and I'm sure you felt it, when you first walked into Victor Hugo's, you know, as a teenager, and you said to yourself, you know, you knew you were gay or you had a good suspicion, but you finally felt like you were a part of something bigger, that mm-hmm. you were worthy of a large, clean, nice place to hang out with other people like you. It wasn't an underground community. You had something nice to show for it. And same thing when you went to a place like Ripples or Studio One. It was, in my, at least when I came out, which was in the 80s, it was kind of life-changing. You know, you walk in there, and my first gay bar experience was in, I think, 78. And I wasn't really sure. I didn't even know it was a gay bar when I went in. But I found out within a few minutes when I noticed everybody on the dance floor was male. But it was just so empowering to know that there was a big community out there and you had all these safe places that you could go and be yourself and not worry about, you know, what people were going to think of you or how they were going to judge you for your, you know, for being gay. And it sounds like you were fortunate enough to grow up in a part of the country where there were several of those places right around the corner. You know, it wasn't like growing up in Nebraska and you have to travel 5 hours to get to a gay bar.
Right.
Or,
well, you expressed how I feel about it very articulately. And in fact, one of the reasons why I think what you're doing is important is because for my generation, I mean, this is pre-internet, this is pre, you know, I mean, you had very few places where you could meet people. So people, gay men met other gay men in bars, and bars were a very important cultural institution for our generation. And I think it's important that the history of these places be preserved. And that's exactly what attracted me to what you're doing, is because you're documenting and you're preserving the history of these bars. And, you know, that needs to be done before the generation of you know, people that are now in their 60s, 70s, and 80s pass on. I really appreciate that you have devoted so much of your time to preserving this history.
Well, thank you. And it kind of struck me the same way. I as I said, I went to my first gay bar in 78, so I'm not that far behind you. And I realized when a couple of years ago, I was talking to some friends, we were reminiscing about a bar, about that same bar in Atlanta, Backstreet, that was open 24 hours. And the owner asked me to do something to commemorate the 45th year of their opening. They opened in 75. They actually closed in, I think, 2004, 2005. So they had a 30-year run. But there were still people all over Atlanta talking about it. And when I got to talking to her about it and doing a little research and kind of digitally reconstructing their logo and capturing stories from people about it, it started a kind of process of thinking about all the other bars that were around there. You know, you talk about to Victor Hugo's, and then that reminds you of Ripples. Then you think about Diamond Horseshoe, and then you think about Studio One. It's like a chain reaction because they're all part of the same experience over a number of years. And it occurred to me, and you know, we'll talk about your activism a little bit in a minute, but having that background as well, you realize that when you look at gay history, so much of it is devoted to documenting the activists, the activism, the riots, the uprisings, all the legislation. It's all about legal and, you know, societal imagery. And yet the part of our community that made all these things possible was being just ignored. It was put under the carpet. And, you know, I know that you were involved with a group there called Gay Think. back when you were in college. And I've looked at some of the articles I've been able to find about Gay Think, and it was kind of a revolutionary concept. It was a little bit early for, you know, now we have all these gay student unions at every school in the universe. But back then, that was not something that was common. And you basically took the concept and said, hey, you know, let's present this gay concept as, you know, a more complete picture than just, you know, two guys are having sex with each other. There's a lot more to it. And how do we address the issues of that community? And I'm sure the bars were helpful in distributing that information, you know, and getting you some more information and, I don't know, possibly some funding, because where else were you going to go?
Right.
So
right.
What was the impetus behind Gay Think? How did Gay Think get started?
Well, when I was in my sophomore year in college, I joined the Gay Student Union at Long Beach State, which had been in existence for a few years. In fact, it's the oldest political and social gay organization in Long Beach. It predated the most large cities have Democratic affiliated political gay clubs. In Long Beach, it's called the Lambda Democratic Club. And we were doing things several years before that organization was even in existence. So I joined the Gay Student Union after weeks and weeks of standing outside the door, being afraid to go in. You know, they met every Friday at noon. I finally mustered the courage to go in. And it was just a wonderful place with wonderful people. It was a social club, but it was also a politically active club. And about a year after I joined, you know, there was talk about, well, let's do something really significant. And so what we came up with was a academic conference surrounding gay issues. We called it Gay Think with an exclamation point on the end of it. And it was either the first or second gay academic conference on the West Coast. There may have been one previously at UCLA or in San Francisco, but we were one of the first. And we threw a pretty wide net out there, and we were surprised at how many people said yes. One of our speakers was Vito Russo, who is famous for the celluloid closet. And this was at the very beginning when he was formulating the concept of the celluloid closet. He was doing it as a lecture, and he was showing clips from movies. This is well before he put together the book. And then, of course, there was a movie or a documentary made after his death about it. So we had him. We had Evelyn Hooker, who was a psychologist in the 50s, who was the first to demonstrate that there was the pathologies between gay men and straight men were no different. She did a very scientific study, and she proved that being gay was not a mental illness. And that led directly to the American Psychological Society in the early 70s taking being gay off their list of mental illnesses. And we had authors at the time who had written gay novels there was a long list of people who came to the conference. And then after the conference, we had an after party on the Queen Mary. And we had major people like Christopher Isherwood and his lover Dom Bacardi come to that event. It was really a thrill to meet them, as well as a lot of the older generation gay men who were in that clique with Christopher Isherwood and Dom Bacardi. So it was a very, very successful weekend. And you can, if you Google it, you can find things about it. It's featured somewhat prominently in the autobiography of Vito Russo, because the weekend was apparently a big turning point in his life after having that experience at Long Beach State. It sent him off in a different direction than he had previously. what can I say? It was one of the most important things I've ever done in my life. I mean, when I was younger, I didn't realize this, but now that I'm older, I realize that if you put on, I don't know if it's true that you're put on in the world for a purpose, but if you are, I think that for me, it was gay activism and working towards helping society at large understand that I wouldn't say we're no different than other people, but I would say that we're not a class of people that should be shunned and discriminated against. And, you know, of course, now it's widely accepted that that's not the case, but we're talking 40, 50 years ago. And back then, the zeitgeist was very different than it is now.
After you went through this stage of intellectual activism in college and kind of explored the gay bar scene in Long Beach and Los Angeles after college, did you pretty much come to the realization that you were going to live the rest of your life as part of the gay community openly and proudly?
Did Absolutely. That,
so
I've always been out with all of my family, my coworkers, you know, anybody I come in contact with. I mean, I don't walk up to them and say, "Hi, I'm Tim and I'm gay," but I don't censor my behavior or my words to hide that.
I completely understand. I took over a gay publication in Atlanta in the late 80s. A friend of mine had to leave to go home and take care of some family issues. And he said, "Can you take over this publication for me?" And even in the late 80s, the gay scene was still somewhat clandestine. It wasn't as public as it is now. And in some cities, you know, I think Atlanta, it was in the mid 80s before any gay bar had front facing windows. You know, they were, it just wasn't done. But I took this position running the gay nightlife magazine in Atlanta and suddenly found myself thrust into a situation where every time I made a business contact, I was outing myself. I didn't have a choice. I mean, how do you walk into a place and say, "Hi, I represent this gay publication," and not have them think you're gay? Right. So basically from that point on, there has been no, you know, no backpedaling. And so that's why this project kind of became a little special to me, because, and even when I was coming up with the name for it, I was like, what am I going to call this? You know, I don't want to just call it something stupid or long. And one day I just woke up and I said, "Gay Barchives." And it just stuck, and it just, you know, but I'm so, it's so exciting to hear all these stories from people, you know, like yourself. I've interviewed some club owners that were in their 80s that had clubs back, you know, 30, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, and talked to them about it. And their stories are not going to be here, you know, 20 years from now, they're not going to be around to tell these stories.
Right.
And it's so refreshing to, it kind of snowballs. You know, I know you're I think you're a member of the Gay Barchives group on Facebook. And in that group, I post things periodically about random bars from around the country or names of bars or themes or whatever. And the amount of interaction that I get from all these people who come out of the woodwork and say, "Hey, you know, I was a bartender at the Copa in Key West in 1983. And here's a picture of me behind the bar." And you're like, wow, that's like 40 years ago. You know, it just brings back this whole flood of memories. And it's kind of like, you know, in the mainstream straight world, when people pass down, you know, grandmother's scrapbook from the past, this is our scrapbook. You know, we don't have a line of gay parents and grandparents that have handed down all the stuff to us. We have to rely on each other to share the stories and preserve them for our future. And I'm so glad that there are people like you out there that are, you know, willing to share their stories and tell us about bars from different parts of the country so that we can all understand what it was like, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago in all these different places, and how much similarity there is to the stories, even though I guess in the 70s, a lot of people thought California was a foreign country. I mean, there was, for all intents and purposes, nothing between, you know, the East Coast and the West Coast, except a bunch of small hick towns. Nobody thought of it, you know. California was like way off in the distance. And it's such a big part of our history. It's just so nice to be able to hear the stories and experience that. Now, you had mentioned earlier that 31 years ago, you connected with Marty Kreloff at Studio One. And hopefully we'll get to do a segment with him in the near future. But for people who don't know who he is, I'm going to put up a couple of images of some of his artwork. He is an incredible artist. He does some beautiful work, and it's got a nice kind of modern edge to it. I don't even know how to describe it. It's just so, it's colorful and vibrant. And
he refers to himself as a second generation pop artist. So he came in the decade after Warhol and Lichtenstein, and yeah, all of the original pop artists made their marks. And then there was a second group that came, you know, that was the generation after, and he's a member of that group. And so that's how you would describe his artist, is as pop.
I can definitely see the Warhol. I definitely saw Lichtenstein too, though, except there are no little dots in there. Lichtenstein had a thing for little dots. Right. But I remember, you know, when I was in my early years of college, and my family lived right outside of New York City. And I went with my uncle and my cousins to the Guggenheim, I think it was. And they had a display of Lichtenstein's there at that time. And but larger, it's so much different when you see them in person. You know, seeing these little pictures I'm going to put up of his work, it's not going to do justice to what I'm sure the actual artwork does when you're close to it.
No, the canvases are quite large, and so, but usually they look pretty good when you photograph them and clean them up and put them online. They actually look pretty good. I think his most famous one is called Scream. Have you seen that one yet?
I have.
Janet Leigh in the shower. That's the one that gets a lot of interest from people.
The ones that appeal to me are kind of the, I don't know, gay icons and goddesses.
Oh yeah, he did a lot of movie stars.
Liz Taylor, Rock Hudson, Marilyn Monroe, Lucille Ball, and my teenage heartthrob, or whatever, early 20s heartthrob, Leo DiCaprio. I had the biggest crush on him when he was a teenager. When he first started, you know, getting out there, I was like, oh my God, he's so cute. But so the whole time you've been together, obviously he's completely out as well.
Oh yeah.
Out and open.
He came out, actually, he spent most of his, after college, he went to college in South Florida. And so he started his career on Miami Beach. And in Miami, he's fairly well known. He's like a local celebrity, and he's a fairly well-known artist. In fact, they're doing a retrospective of his career later this year at one of the museum spaces in Miami. I don't have the information with me right now. He did a lot of movie star stuff, and that was very, very popular. In fact, one of his movie star pieces is in the art collection at the Museum of Modern Art. So
very cool.
He's well known for that.
Well, we'll get into that when I get a chance to interview him and really talk about his art and what inspired it and what his experiences were like in his days in Miami, as well as, you know, when he moved out west.
What I was going to say was that when Anita Bryan did her hate campaign to try to deny anybody who has said anything positive about gay people to be teachers. It wasn't just that she wanted to ban gay teachers. She wanted to ban anybody who said anything positive about homosexuality. And Marty was so outraged that he did an interview in the Miami Herald where he came out. And it was a big deal back then because he was well known. And he did that article, and he did a lot of political artwork at the time. There was another retrospective that traveled the country over the last couple of years that was called Art After Stonewall, which was how the gay community reacted to Stonewall and the AIDS epidemic over a period of years. And Marty had several pieces in that as well. So he was well known for his activism.
I look forward to talking to him about that when I get a chance to interview him. And I really appreciate you taking the time to share some of these memories with us so that we can all kind of preserve them. And people who come behind us, you know, the right. people who are in their 20s and 30s now, 40s, they can understand a little bit more about where we all came from. And so I really appreciate you taking the time to do this and telling us about your stories from Long Beach and Los Angeles. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
And that concludes another segment of the Gabe Archives podcast. You can find more podcasts at GabeArchives.com/podcast. We also have more information about this podcast and links to the other podcasts we have completed. We hope you enjoy your trip down memory lane.